Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with the fabulous and very fit Rob Moore, still maintaining his tan after his trip to Hawaii, and Levi Waldron back from Guatemala. For people who are regular listeners to the show, you might have heard Levi talk briefly about some of his experiences in Guatemala and trying to travel as a vegan in Guatemala, and you had quite a successful trip, but we got cut off in the middle of our interview when we had you on, so I'm going to maybe ply you with some questions about the trip still at the end of the program. But before we jump into hearing a bit more from Levi, we're going to give you a bit of an intro to our show, which is, I don't know exactly who this is geared towards. I wasn't sure if it was for vegans who have people in your life maybe that you're trying to educate about dairy, or if you're a vegetarian or omnivore in the world and you're just curious about the dairy industry. I think a lot of people think that the dairy industry is much less cruel than the meat industry, and often there's a disconnect between the dairy industry and the veal industry, which often I think people know that is, you know, pretty cruel in terms of baby cows being in crates and not being able to move around, but of course that's a byproduct of the dairy industry. So we're going to be speaking with Stephanie Brown about what happens exactly on dairy farms in Canada. Specifically, we're going to be talking about the industrial dairy industry. And Brown is sort of the leading expert, I would say, in terms of Canadian food politics. She's the farm animal advisor for Animal Alliance of Canada, and she's also a member of the steering committee for the Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals. And we'll give you all the relevant information in terms of finding out more about their websites and their campaigns throughout the program. So we're going to hear from Stephanie, and then at the end of the program, instead of the beginning of the program, we're going to hear some news from Rob Moore. Thanks, Stephanie, for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Before we came on air, I was speaking with Levi Waldron, who is our guest for today in studio, and Rob, and we're talking about some of the myths that are, I think, perpetuated both by the dairy industry and by a lot of consumers of dairy. We just wanted to kind of rattle through them at the beginning of the show, and one of them is that that cows need to be milked, and that if we weren't there to milk them, that they would, you know, I don't know, maybe explode. What do you think is the logical conclusion of that, Levi? That they just need to be milked, and we're kind of doing them a favor. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, they need to be milked because they've been forced to have a calf. The only reason that they produce milk is to supply food for their calf, and they're required to have a calf every year, repeatedly. So it's all for the human purpose of milking cows. In fact, when the calf is born, the calf is taken away from the mother on short order, usually within the day, so that humans can have the milk. And if the calf is kept, he or she is kept on a milk replacer and then sometimes on grain. But it's rather self-serving to say that we're doing cows a favor by milking them. In fact, they do get swollen udders in many cases from the production, and it relieves them, yes, but it's to relieve them to feed to humans.
And the calves, you said that they're taken away soon after. How soon after, typically? That we're speaking specifically about the Canadian dairy industry, so
right.
How long does it take before the calves are taken away on typical industrial dairy farms in Canada?
Well, it can vary, but typically it's done the first day, and sometimes within hours. Sometimes it might be a couple of days or 3 days. But the first day is not atypical at all. So it's very, very quick, and it deprives both the calf and the mother of the opportunity to interface and to get to know one another. And sometimes even the calf doesn't get the colostrum, which is very necessary for health reasons because it provides antibodies to the calf for its life. And sometimes the calves are sold immediately to slaughter. Those are bob calves. At even a day, they may be shipped to a slaughterhouse, or they may be shipped to a market and then shipped to a slaughterhouse. And those wee babies are allowed to be shipped for as long as 18 hours, if you can believe. And sometimes some of the veal producers in Ontario ship animals in from other states or other provinces. And so you can imagine the state that these poor little creatures are in when they've been shipped 18 hours without feed, without access to the social needs that they have from their mother, the opportunity to suckle. It's just really a bad scene, all told.
When I was doing my master's, I was remembering I was doing some research on the dairy industry and reading some of the veal producers' literature, and they talked about themselves as being a recycler of an otherwise unwanted byproduct and really sort of positioning themselves as environmentalists in terms of this industry.
Again, it's a very self-serving response. Those unwanted male dairy cows are there because the cows have been forced to become pregnant again. They're impregnated artificially by insemination, and half of the calves that are born are males, and they're a byproduct of the dairy industry. No other way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit more about some of the experiences then, or at least what you understand the cows go through when the calves are taken away. I think one of the main stereotypes about many domesticated animals, especially so-called food animals, and especially cows, is that they don't really mind. They're kind of dull-witted. It's, you know, not a big deal if they're not seeing their babies. Is this what your experience is, or what the scientific research shows in terms of trauma caused to cows?
There's definitely trauma. Animals are very social beings. They're herd animals. They like to be in groups. When the calves are taken away, they can go into one of several types of housing. Sometimes the heifers, the females, are kept in hutches. Some go for grain feeding and some go for milk feeding, which we should be talking about soon, hopefully. It's very much a deprivation, and anyone who's been on a dairy farm is well aware of the bawling that goes on between both calf and cow when the calf is taken away. The birthing process for calves is not easy. So the cows go through pain and suffering for the process of birth, and then the calf is taken away as a double whammy. Just every way you look at it, cows are misused, abused, and then tossed out.
Another thing that I've been told by a couple of people who are not experts is that in modern dairy farms, often they don't impregnate the cows anymore. They just use hormones to make them produce milk.
No, they're artificially inseminated, typically. There are a few instances where the typical bull is used with the female, but much more commonly is artificial insemination. Hormones are used to increase production, but after a point, the milk production goes down, so they have to be so-called freshened or have another calf. Just after the calf is taken away, the milk production is the highest, and it gets progressively lessened. But meanwhile, she's been impregnated again, so for 7 months of her 9-month pregnancy, she is producing milk. So it's a double whammy on her body. Not only is she carrying a calf, but she's producing milk. And to do this, it's very hard physiologically on the cow's body. There's a UK veterinarian named John Webster who's at the University of Bristol, and he's likened the physiological stress on a cow as equivalent to a human who would have to jog 6 to 8 hours a day. I mean, this wears these cows out. It's an incredible physiological push on their bodies to carry a calf and to produce milk at this incredibly high rate that today's cows do produce.
Stephanie, how old is a female cow before she starts being put into milk production and artificially inseminated?
She's typically inseminated about 15 months, and then at about 24 months, she has her first calf.
And they are impregnated, you said, once a year?
Mm-hmm.
Until what? Until they can't give milk anymore? Until they die? What?
Yeah, it could be one of several things. The production may go down. Their bodies may wear out. They become lame. They may have a calving injury. They may become calcium depleted. And then these animals sometimes are the animals that become downer cows. And this has been a terrible problem in Canada and particularly in Ontario. Now, the good news is that the CFIA has introduced a new standard for dealing with downer animals, and there are definitely fewer of them appearing at auction marts and at slaughter plants, but these animals just become so physiologically deprived or have injuries that they're worn out after 5 years.
How old can dairy cows live otherwise if they weren't being repeatedly impregnated this way?
They could live typically 20 to 25 years.
Wow.
So it's a very shortened.
And so these dairy cows that are, the industry often refers to them as being spent cows, do they end up in our provincial and federal slaughterhouses? Where do they go?
Yes.
And do they enter the food supply? Are they going, like, into the human food supply? Yeah. Are they going into pet food?
Well, it could be some pet food, but they're the typical hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
The dairy cows, the so-called cull cows, are what you buy at a ground beef place or a hamburger place. That's what they are. After these animals have gone through this incredible pressure on their bodies, then they become hamburger.
So let's just rewind for a moment. I'd like you to talk more about the downers. What exactly is a downer, and how prevalent is it in Ontario?
Well, it was very prevalent. The Animal Alliance of Canada did a really good job over the past 10 years to document the downers in the province of Ontario through getting data from OMAF, from Freedom of Information Request, so that they could understand really what animals were suffering and what kind of conditions they were facing before they were dragged to slaughter. I have here a list of some of the examples from, this happens to be 2002, a three-month period, April to June. And specific animals are cited here, and so one has peritonitis, pneumonia, a leg is splayed out, another a uterine tear, a ruptured uterus from calving.
And these are all conscious animals that were experiencing these.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then they were dragged to slaughter and in a most horrendous fashion, using chains and any other means that could be used to move. And these are heavy animals. I mean, you know, these can be 1,500-pound animals. So it's not easy to move such an animal.
And they're supposed to be euthanized on site, right?
Now the ruling is, yes, that they should be. And I think it's happening more. But it's still quite early in the game to see exactly how successful the whole process. It came into effect as of February 1st, the new standard. So that's a federal standard. And the question is still in Ontario whether it's happening the same with the provincial plants. Because when the Roland Haynes report, the meat inspection review, was published in July of last year, he's still suggesting that it's okay to transport downers. He's saying, yeah, there should be research. Yes, people should be trained who are going to do this, but they don't unequivocally say don't transport these downer animals. So from what I'm hearing, there are many fewer occurring at the auction marts, but it still remains to be seen just how effective at the provincial level and how much it's enforced that they not be shipped.
Yeah, are these animal welfare standards, are they voluntary at this point?
Well, no, in terms of the regulation that CFIA put in, it is a regulation under the Health of Animals Act, and so it's essentially law.
But what are the consequences if the farmers violate these
regulations? Well, that's a good point. And one thing that we can't really find out very effectively is what the consequences are in terms of fines. Now, CFIA has a system called AMPS, where they're supposedly asking for monetary penalties for infractions of various transport issues, but they don't publish the outcome of their use of these penalties. And so we're asking that these should be publicized just as the prosecutions, if and ever they do occur, are publicized. The more frequent events would be the use of these AMP penalties. But when you don't know what kind of fines are being imposed or whether they're actually indeed being paid, it's hard to assess the effectiveness of the whole system.
Right, so these regulations probably aren't enough to soothe the conscience that may be worried that dairy is still quite cruel in Canada, that this isn't necessarily cleaning up the problem entirely.
No, it isn't, because even if an animal isn't a downer and isn't involved in that whole very difficult and painful process, the cows are still intensively reared such that they're, as I mentioned earlier, producing both calves and milk at the same time, and their bodies wear out, you know, so quickly. So those physiological changes are happening whether or not they actually become a downer. And certainly all cows do not become downers. They're shipped before they become that bad. But they are worn out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all very premature. And then the life of the calf is another whole bad scenario. Very short, pathetic, sad lives these animals lead.
Well, give us a picture then of sort of the average dairy cow and the average dairy calf on an industrial plant. What would you see if you were to go into an industrial dairy farm? What would be some of the visuals that you would have, or some of the smells even, or the sounds? What would you see when you go there?
Well, you see animals either in tie stalls or free stalls. Some of them are tied up, and they're milked with portable milking machines. The free stall animals are able to move about more and would go to a milking parlor.
It sounds like such a nice term,
yeah,
the milking parlor.
It does, but bear in mind these animals are carrying a whole lot. They may be carrying 20 liters of milk, and they're desperate to be milked. You've probably seen some of these cows that have very enlarged udders. I mean, it's really disgusting looking because they have inflammations of the udder such that they have bacterial infections.
Is that what's referred to commonly as mastitis?
That's right, yeah. And even after several lactations, some of the cow's legs become sort of splayed out because of this giant udder that she has between her legs. So it's, you know, conditions are, again, I go back to this physiological condition that affects cows. It's just wear and tear on their bodies like you wouldn't believe.
I think the pastoral scene that is very intentionally cultivated by the dairy industry is one in which the cows are sort of, you know, happily frolicking in the field. A friend of mine was telling me that there's even new commercials that have, I think this, I don't know if they're U.S.-based, but where cows are dancing and they're really happy to be giving their milk. And it's just kind of, it's kind of the typical bucolic scene of sort of peace and tranquility, these rolling hills and fresh pastures for cows. Are they actually allowed outside at all?
It depends. Some of them maybe go out to a paddock, but some of them don't. And the paddock isn't, like a nice pasture. It's just a muddy little area. Organic animals used for organic milk are to be put outside, but they aren't certainly the norm. Only like 1% of the milk produced in Canada is organic, so it's still a very small market. But then getting back to your earlier question, where you were asking about what happens to the veal cows.
Yeah.
That is a really sad scenario, and the one good thing is a lot of people seem to be aware of what veal really is and the pain and suffering that is attached to that whole scenario. But for what we've known as milk-fed veal, animals are given only a milk replacer, and they're deprived of iron, they're deprived of solid food, which they need to develop their rumen, and they've become bloated and suffer diarrhea. Sometimes they get pneumonia.
What's their rumen?
The rumen is the four-part section of their stomach where they digest their food. It's what makes an animal a ruminant.
Mm-hmm.
So they need roughage to develop their bodies, because if they were out on the pasture the whole time, they would suckle from their mother, then ultimately they would start eating grass, and it would be a combination of some milk and some grass, and then ultimately they would go on all pasture. But it's not that way for these milk-fed veal calves. They're kept in stalls in many instances. They can't turn around. They can get no exercise. They can't groom. And as we noted earlier, they're separated from their mother. They can't suckle. They may be given just a bucket of this milk replacer twice a day. And it's just a scenario where these are sick animals, basically, when they're anemic and iron deprived. And then the outcome is that to handle all this condition, they're given antibiotics in their feed. Because of all the deprivation, they also may suffer stereotypical neurotic behaviors where they're constantly kind of moving back and forth or doing something called tongue rolling or hair licking because they're trying to get a little bit of iron even from their own bodies. When they can't turn around, you can just imagine. I mean, these are animals that are really going crazy. And then they're taken to slaughter at about 16 weeks. So that's the life of the products of these dairy cows.
The industry information that I've read about dairy, they'll often talk about how, yes, we do have these animals in these stalls, and we realize that we're restricting their movement, but because we're so concerned about the health of the animal and also the health of the product that is produced, we need to have them contained in order to monitor their health and administer various medications and keep them as sanitary as possible by keeping them away from each other.
Well, they're right about the health of the animals. I mean, they're definitely not healthy animals. And I read some interesting statistics in Ontario Farmer, which is a weekly newspaper, that said 15%, this is an article from November 2004, It said 15% of the male bull calves die, and 10% of the heifer female calves die, which is an incredibly large percentage of animals to die. They're doing this because they're unhealthy, they're neurotic, they're just not well off. And the industry is trying to do things to improve it, and things like ensuring that they get colostrum, which is nature's way of providing antibodies. Sometimes they don't get it when an animal's taken away so early from the mum, at, say, day one. If the calf hasn't gotten an opportunity to get the colostrum, they're going to be subject to illness and disease. And being transported 18 hours from a farm in Newfoundland or New York State or Wisconsin to Ontario, I mean, you can imagine these animals are not well animals. And so separating them into separate confinement little units, hutches or crates, is their solution to providing health. But it's, again, a huge cost to the animals.
Why are they milk-fed exactly? I assume it has to do with economics.
They're milk-fed because they want to keep the flesh of these calves white. And so they're essentially anemic animals or on the verge of anemia. And it's a very expensive meat. If you go to a fancy restaurant and order white veal, you pay a lot of money for it. And so the veal producers are prepared to accept the losses of the 15% of animals in Ontario because the animals that they do sell, they get so much return from.
And what about the grain-fed veal calves, so-called veal calves?
Mm-hmm. They get a combination of milk, and then they're put on to grain, and again, high-protein foods before they go to slaughter. The males are castrated, and of course, the males are castrated without any anesthetic. There's a book I really recommend that you might want to read. It's called Portrait of a Burger as a Young Calf,
mm-hmm.
by an author named Peter Lobenheim, and he follows a grain-fed veal calf throughout its life, including the birth, and even he sort of backtracks to do the artificial insemination so that he understands fully how the bulls are treated, who provide the semen for the cows that are inseminated, and then the various processes that the calves go through. It's a sad tale, really.
Can you give us the title again?
Yeah, it's Portrait of a Burger as a Young Calf.
And the author?
Peter Lobenheim, L-O-V-E-N-H-E-I-M.
Do you have a sense of the numbers of cows that are currently being milked in Ontario or Canada at this point?
Yeah. The numbers for all of Canada in 2003, which is the most recent statistic that I have, are 1,006,000. And those numbers are going down every year, ironically, but the production is staying the same. So that means that the individual cows are producing more milk per cow.
Hmm.
And the size of farms tends to be increasing as well. So you're getting fewer dairy farms, larger numbers of cows per farm, and increasing quantities of milk per cow.
And what about calves?
One statistic I have is 3,300,000 calves slaughtered for veal in 2003.
And so if I'm, you know, your average consumer and I'm going to a Loblaws and picking up some dairy from the back freezer and, let's say, a chunk of mozzarella or whatever, how do I know where that cheese is coming from, that sort of nondescript cellophane wrap block of yellow? How do we know where it's coming from? Could it be coming from a U.S. farm, or how do we know where it's coming from and what the conditions are?
Well, you don't know. I think you should assume that it's coming from the conditions that I've described, unless it's certified organic, in which case the standards are better. The dairy farmers of Canada are quite strict and quite diligent to control the imports of cheeses and yogurt, et cetera. It's a protectionist policy that they want to maintain because they're worried that their industry is going to be flooded. And actually, our system is quite different from Canada. We have supply management where farmers buy quota to be allowed to sell their milk, and it's very expensive. I mean, some farmers can own $1 million worth of quota, and if the World Trade Organization were to say to some of the pressures that have been being put by, for instance, New Zealand against Canada, because they want to get away from those conditions where we control how much we produce and what the price is going to be and how much we import, and if it became a total free market, then we would be just totally subject to whatever would come into the country. Mm. But right now there are some controls, but one thing that they're lobbying for right now, the dairy industry, is to keep out what they call butter oil for Canadian ice cream. Milk can be broken down into its components, and bits and pieces of it sold for various functions. You know, only actually about 40% of the milk that's produced goes into what they call table milk and cream, and the rest of it goes into yogurt and ice cream and butter and cheese.
I wanted to address, maybe you can give us some insight into whether this is true for the Canadian industry as well. I think it was People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, was talking about that there is a certain amount of pus that is allowed into milk products, that there is actually like a ratio that is allowed per, you know, whatever, milk molecules to the pus that is originating from such infections as mastitis, which you talked about before, the infection of the udder. And could you tell us if that's true in Canada as well? Is making its way into milk?
Oh, yeah, it is. It's called somatic cell count, and it's the number of cells that are pus, essentially, or bacterial. And, yeah, at a certain point then, if the ratio goes too high, then the milk can't be shipped. And so, naturally, farmers don't want to have their milk subject to being held back. And so when the cows suffer mastitis and the somatic cell count is affected, then that's when they're shipped.
Hmm. And one last myth that I'd like you to address, if it is a myth, is that these animals, if they were really treated so badly, they wouldn't produce milk.
Well, I think it is a myth. I mean, you don't stop, or a cow or another animal doesn't stop producing because they're suffering. They can have leg injuries. They can have any number of physiological deformities or conditions that are unhealthy, but their bodies continue to produce. And when they're given this high-energy feed that they are given, which can be animal protein, which is probably how BSE got into the first Canadian BSE cow, yeah, the body continues to produce milk. It continues to produce a calf. You can't use production as an indicator of health and welfare.
Hmm. So when you give a talk, such as this one, and I'm sure you've horrified many different people in the audience who, you know, are beginning to look at this industry in a more critical way, and they say, okay, well, what now? This is something that I'm often asked at talks. Okay, what do we do now? Can you give us maybe some resources or your recommendations for what people can do? Do you suggest that people buy organics? Do you suggest, you know, a vegan diet? What is your take on where people should go in terms of being more critical about the dairy industry?
Well, it's a personal decision, certainly. And I would recommend that if somebody wants more information about dairy or any other animals that are intensely confined for food purposes, you go to our website of the Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals. That web address is humanefood.ca. We have fact sheets, and there are recommendations on our fact sheets. And things that you can do are to not buy dairy or to cut back on dairy, to buy certified organic only. I mean, that's a good step. And so, yeah, we think that education is awfully important. And once people become aware of it, they hopefully will decide that they want to buy what is the most humane, or even not buy it at all. I mean, that again, it's a personal choice. Everyone isn't prepared to become vegan, but maybe they are prepared to cut back on the quantities of dairy products that they use. And that's the first step. So there are some options out there, but first everyone should be educated. They should know what they're buying. They should know what an animal has gone through to produce that product. And if you still want to buy it, then okay, but you're at least familiar with what you're doing. And hopefully you will respond and act in accordance with what you know.
We had an interview, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, where we spoke with a woman. Was it last week, Rob, where the woman was talking about how she went off dairy primarily, or one of her motivating factors and continual motivating factors, she went off dairy once she became a mother because she couldn't bear the thought of taking the milk from another animal that was intended for her baby, mm-hmm. for her own child. And I thought that was a really interesting take in terms of addressing the organics industry. I think a lot of people think, well, I'll just buy organic, and then mm-hmm. and then everything is kind of tied up, yeah. And that's the end of the story.
Yeah, well, but again, organic is better, but it's not 100%, because the animals still go to slaughter, and they're still rough conditions. And you know what the other interesting thing is? That only humans eat the milk of another species. Now, cats and dogs have been trained to do it by humans, so they eat cow's milk, et cetera. But most species don't eat other species' milk. So, again, it's sort of an unnatural scenario in the first place. And once you've been a mother and once you've nursed a baby, you do have an understanding and an appreciation, too, of what it is to have a full breast and what a cow suffers if she's got a full udder. I mean, it's not comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we're transporting animals with full udders and they're not be able to get milked as they should be. So there's all kinds of really difficult and unpleasant scenarios that are associated with the industry that...
It's so bizarre and interesting. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that the dairy industry has tried to portray a picture of itself in which milk is seen as being all about purity and all about being natural. And someone was saying to me the other day about, you know, when's the last time you saw someone, like a grown man, suckling naturally at the teat of a cow?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's kind of a bizarre, it's a really
mm-hmm.
bizarre image.
It is.
But at the same time, it's such a powerful one, I think, still in this culture.
The dairy industry is a very powerful lobby, and they've been very successful in continuing some of these myths. But you have to wonder how, in the scheme of things, the direction is the right thing. I mean, certainly there's been doctors that are saying that milk isn't even the best thing for women for calcium, that there are better options. So a lot of myths going on that are perpetuated. And even the immigration patterns of Canada are affecting milk drinking patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry is worried about some of these things because many cultures are lactose intolerant. And that affects what people eat, what they choose to eat. So they have to sort of do double duty to keep up the message that, and that's why they've had a number of these ads that appeal to young people with the skater ads and barn dances and stuff. It's supposed to be really cool.
Stephanie, we're just wrapping up the interview. I wanted to thank you so much for being on the program today.
My pleasure.
And for your work with Animal Alliance. I'll give that website as well for people who are interested. It's animalalliance.ca, and Animal Alliance is all one word. And then, of course, Stephanie plugged the website, which is a really good one for information about the dairy industry, called humanefood.ca, and Humane Food is all one word. We were asked by Dave Shishkoff, an activist on the West Coast, to plug the website dairyinfo.ca, which has lots of Canadian-based information as well. Again, that's dairyinfo.ca. And Stephanie, I just wanted to ask you quickly at the end of the program, and I probably should have asked you this at the beginning, but so often animal advocates are accused of being biased and they have their own agendas. And I'm curious about how you respond to people in terms of questioning where you get your information from or what your sources or agendas are in terms of this issue.
Well, there's this kind of rural versus urban myth that the urban people don't know anything, and we're always sort of challenged as, oh, you know, you don't really know what happens on the farm. And I find that kind of interesting because we're all consumers. We all have the right, and we all have to choose what we're going to eat. So it's really just a defensive argument. But there's many ways to learn about how animals are raised. One thing even that I find really useful is to monitor the farm press, to read the publications that the industry puts out. So it's not colored by the animal welfare movement or the animal rights movement. It's what industry is saying to other industry people. You can really sort of get a good perspective of what's happening because they're honest. So there's lots of ways that you can find information, and I think it's our duty to be knowledgeable and not to misrepresent issues. I certainly don't want to. But if you are ever wrong in an area, they're very quick to jump on you, and not surprisingly.
Yep.
But that's just part of what we do.
Stephanie, thanks so much again for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
It was a really, really good show, and I'm glad that we have such an expert in Canada, because it's really difficult to find information about the dairy industry, I find, and it's just an issue that isn't talked about enough.
You're right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We were just speaking with Stephanie Brown, and she is the Farm Animal Advisor for Animal Alliance of Canada, and she's also a member of the Steering Committee for the Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals, and we reached her in Toronto. You can check out our archives for Animal Voices. Many archives, more than 100 archive programs are on our website, and that is animalvoices.ca. You can always write us, drop us a line, give us any feedback about the show at animalvoices@ciut.fm. Over to you, Rob, with the news.
In this week's news, cormorants are being killed again as we speak. The FBI targets eco-terrorists, and Canada tries again at an animal cruelty bill. And from the Toronto Star about those cormorants, the killing of thousands of birds at a provincial park is a senseless slaughter that will pose more damage to the environment than it will prevent, environmental groups complained last week. The cull of 5,500 cormorants at Presque Isle Provincial Park near Trenton, scheduled for this week, was ordered by the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources to prevent damage to trees and shoreline vegetation from the birds' droppings. But Liz White, Executive Director of Animal Alliance Canada, said the dark-colored water birds, which have long hooked bills, long tails, and a wingspan of more than 1.2 meters, are a necessary part of the ecosystem. The ecosystem is now inundated with the ministry's hunters and their trailers, off-road vehicles, and other gear, she said. Ministry officials said they are conducting the cull after scientists said the devastation wrought by the birds threatens other wildlife. They pretty much destroyed this one little island, said Jeanette Albert, spokeswoman with the ministry. If we don't reduce the number, there will be further decimation of the park's wooded areas, which harms the habitat of other waterbird species. Animal rights activists plan to canoe around the park, which is a peninsula that attracts migrating birds and other waterfowl, starting yesterday to protest the cull. This year's cull is the second. Last year, 6,000 cormorants were killed. Officials have also been oiling cormorant eggs to curb future populations. Next, from the Independent out of the UK, the FBI has sounded a new and surprising alarm, suggesting environmental and animal welfare militants are now the biggest terrorist threat in the U.S., increasingly using incendiary devices on targets ranging from housing developments and research laboratories to car dealerships. John Lewis, the agency's deputy assistant director for counterterrorism, told the Senate committee in Washington that the militant groups were, quote, way out in front, end quote, in economic damage. He also suggested it would not be long before loss of human life was added to their tally of crimes. The hearing held by the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee was an unusual detour from the U.S. government's more familiar preoccupation with terrorist threats from foreign groups such as Al-Qaeda. The FBI said it has 150 investigations into 1,200 crimes allegedly committed by eco-terrorists and animal welfare militants between 1990 and 2004. I'll let the irony there speak for itself. And from the Department of Justice's media release in Ottawa, on May 16, 2005, Erwin Kotler, Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada, introduced legislation in the House of Commons which modernizes and strengthens Canada's animal cruelty laws. Canadians want legislation to protect against cruelty and contempt for animal well-being, and they expect the criminal justice system to treat such behavior seriously, said Minister Kotler. This legislation will effectively modernize our legal protection against intentional cruelty to animals and increase maximum penalties, available for such cruelty and for criminal neglect of animals. Animal cruelty provisions in the Criminal Code target those who knowingly or recklessly cause unnecessary pain, suffering, or injury to an animal, or cause pain or injury through criminally negligent conduct. Specific changes to the Criminal Code, well, I'll quickly go through these, no longer classify animal cruelty offenses as property crimes, make it illegal to brutally or viciously kill animals. I wonder what that will do to the slaughterhouses. Of course, they're exempt, aren't they? Raise the penalty for intentional cruelty to a maximum of 5 years imprisonment, up from the current 6-month penalty. Give judges the authority to raise the fine for summary convictions to $10,000 from the current maximum fine of $2,000, and for indictable offenses, remove the cap on fines entirely. Remove the 2 years maximum for an order prohibiting someone who was convicted from owning an animal, and give judges the authority to order anyone found guilty of animal cruelty to pay restitution to the animal welfare organization that subsequently cared for the animal. I find that really interesting. Mm-hmm. By increasing penalties and no longer classifying animal cruelty as property crimes, these amendments send a strong message that animal cruelty is about violence, and that is completely unacceptable, said Minister Kotler. Extensive consultation with animal industry groups has taken place over the past several years, leading to various changes to the amendments initially proposed. These amendments strike the appropriate balance between strongly denouncing cruelty as a crime of violence, while at the same time making it clear that lawful and humane practices in a range of contexts, such as scientific research and agriculture, will not be affected. The proposed legislation also affirms traditional Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights. An online version of the proposed legislation is available at www.parl.gc.ca.
And that'll be posted on our website, or you can post it maybe, because some of the acronyms are just difficult.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, so sure, I'll post that online for everyone to read. And we do have a few minutes left, so I'll read this last story that I thought was interesting from the Toronto Star in the money section last week. It's no big news for, you know, vegans or animal rights people, but I thought it was interesting to read for those listeners who maybe are new to veganism, don't know why they should change. I just thought this was a great article. Again,
why should I change?
Again, in the money section, I thought, why is this in the money section? Anyway, from the Toronto Star, it starts, Vicky Fecto and her husband stopped eating meat 5 years ago. They didn't like the way animals were treated in factory farms. When we first went vegetarian, I didn't see any big difference in our grocery bills, she admits. Instead of doing all her shopping at one store, she now goes to two grocery chains and ranges farther afield to health food stores. Fecto has started a website, www.veggierevolution.com, to give recipes and ideas on switching. She's not a dietitian, just an ordinary person who wants to dispel the myth that vegetarian diets are boring. People were always asking me, "What do you eat?" So I included a list of meals I ate over an entire week, she says. She's added a section on quick meals featuring convenience foods such as falafel mix, mock meats, and fajitas, which are easy to make for dinner after a long day at work. It's actually good if someone asks me, what do you eat? I'll just give them my website. Beef, pork, chicken, and fish tend to be the most expensive parts of a meal, so you should save big by cutting them out, or at least by cutting them back. Replacing meats with beans and whole grains, which cost pennies a serving, should make a dent in your food bill. But you can spend as much or more on fresh fruits and vegetables, especially organic produce, which is more costly to grow without pesticides or chemical fertilizers and sells at a premium. The Toronto Vegetarian Society provides cost-cutting tips at its website, www.veg.ca. It advises buying in bulk, using leftover fresh vegetables for soups or stews, and buying instant ramen noodle soup. Look for the Veg Society's Directory of Resources in Toronto and the surrounding area. In 2003, the Dietitians of Canada and the American Dietetic Association issued a joint statement saying that well-planned vegetarian diets can be healthy alternatives to standard meat-based eating styles for all age groups. Vegetarians have been reported to have healthier body weight than non-vegetarians, as well as lower rates of death from heart disease, lower blood cholesterol levels, and lower rates of high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and prostate and colon cancer, said registered dietitian and spokesperson Vicento Molina. The best way to ensure a healthy vegetarian diet, they say, is to consult a registered dietitian. You can find one in your area at www.dietitians.ca. Cutting back on meat is also environmentally friendly. One of the first books to make the argument was Frances Moore Lappé's Diet for a Small Planet, published in 1971. She said 16 pounds of grains, soybeans, and other plant foods are needed to make just 1 pound of beef. Using this food for cattle when it could be fed to far greater numbers of people is wasteful. Another influential book and past guest of Animal Voices by John Robbins called Diet for a New America. John Robbins was a vegetarian whose dad helped build the Baskin-Robbins ice cream empire. He pointed out that cattle produced methane, one of the gases believed to be responsible for global warming. He also said that feeding a meat eater requires 3.25 acres of agricultural land a year. In contrast, a vegetarian needs just half an acre a year, and vegans who eat no dairy products or eggs need a mere 1/6 of an acre. So what if you're rushing to get a healthy dinner on the table at night? How do you make fast meals with less meat? Carbohydrates should make up the bulk of your diet and about half of your daily calories, says the Vegetarian Times Complete Cookbook. Whole grains such as brown rice, whole wheat flour or bread, rolled oats, millet or barley are good choices. In planning menus, think rice pilafs, mushroom and barley soup, pasta, grain-based burgers and other sandwiches, stuffed vegetables and croquettes made with couscous. Some books that the author recommends are Quickies 2, Veggies and More by Mondo Rosenberg, and The Ultimate Healthy Eating Plan by Liz Pearson and Marilyn Smith. She also recommends a website called www.5to10aday.com to learn more about how to incorporate fruits and vegetables into your daily meals. Again, from the money section in the Toronto Star. By one of their staff writers. Who would have thunk?
You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5. That was Rob Moore giving us our weekly news digest. Thanks for that.
Sure.
I wanted to quickly plug a new cafe that opened up in Kensington Market in Toronto at 64 Oxford Street, and it's called Urban Herbivore. And I'll just give you the little blurb that the Toronto Vegetarian Association just put out. Urban Herbivore is a vegan cafe. They offer a cooking school, catering, and prepared takeaway foods. The cafe features 4 fresh sandwiches, including grilled veggies, barbecue tofu, avocado, and sesame tempeh, 4 green salads, drinks, and baked goodies. The food is served in brown wax paper containers, and the drinks are served in bioplastic cups made from corn. Who knew? There are 8 stools and 2 benches outside, and the prepared takeaway items include bottled fresh soups, packaged dips and dressings. Everything is organic except for some of the fresh produce. And this cafe is run by Stephen Gardner, who's the owner and chef of the upscale vegan restaurant Fressen. And he describes his style as modern herbivorous, combining mouth-watering taste with elegant presentation. And that is totally true. And you can also find out more about Urban Herbivore by going to the Toronto Vegetarian Association website, which is, I think, TVA. Toronto Vegetarian Association?
Veg.ca.
There you go. And he's going to, I don't know how much I should give away, but Stephen's been really good to the program, and he often, during our fundraising drive, he gives us a dinner for two that we get to give away to one of our listeners, and he is going to be giving us a big treat.
A big treat.
So we're not gonna tell you what exactly, but it's not a meal, but it's gonna be big. So we're gonna do that in hopefully a couple weeks. We're gonna have him on the program. So definitely go check out Urban Herbivore. And Rob, you were there the other week, right?
I was, yeah. And it's really great. It really is a takeout place because it only seats 6, but really great sandwiches, really big sandwiches. You can even split one between 2 people. They're $6, and a really great environment, really cool setup. And a great addition to Kensington Market.
Yeah, it's awesome. I think I'm going to wander over there maybe today, bring Levi along. Levi, I know we didn't get a chance to talk about some of your experiences, but I did want to have you back on the program, and you're going to be talking with us about the relationship between veganism, animal rights, and cycling after many years of cycling advocacy that you've done. So we're going to have you back on the program, hopefully in the next couple of weeks sometime.
I look forward to it.
Yeah, and you can tell us more about some of your observations of being a vegan in Guatemala and being able to maintain a vegan diet, which you did with flying colors. So thanks again to Michelle for teching for us today. It was awesome to have you here. You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner.